Good morning.
Good morning.
We have five cases on the calendar this morning. A tax case from the Court of Federal Claims, two patent cases from district courts, a trade case from the Court of International Trade, and a veterans case. The latter being submitted only in the briefs and will not be argued. So the first case is Massachusetts Mutual Life Insurance versus the United States, 2014-5019. Mr. Catterall.
May it please the Court. I'm Arthur Catterall of the Justice Department on behalf of the government today. MassMutual has hundreds of thousands of individual contracts with policyholders under which it has no obligation to pay the annual declared dividend unless the policy remains in force on the policy anniversary date in the year following the year of declaration.
But there was a commitment, wasn't there? There was a resolution, a board resolution?
There was a board resolution. There was, which we will get to. MassMutual acknowledges
what
that.
What exactly is the contingency, though, that you think still exists with respect to that?
Because the purported group obligation is entirely derivative of all of these existing individual contractual obligations, there can't be an identifiable group of persons who are entitled, who would be entitled to receive the guarantee.
Do you have to identify the precise recipients in order to know that the obligation is guaranteed?
No, you do not have to identify precise recipients. What we are saying is that in this case, because you have existing individual contracts that address the same subject matter as the group obligation that was just sort of overlaid on top of it, that in order for anyone to become entitled to the guaranteed amount, they first have to have become entitled to the annual dividend under the terms of the individual.
But isn't it true that all it means is that someone has to be left that is entitled at the end of the day?
Someone, as of December 31st, someone has to have been entitled to the annual dividend under the terms of the individual contracts in order for the so-called group obligation to have been fixed at that time.
So if even one person remains standing...
Well, the thing is, nobody becomes entitled to the annual dividend payable in the next year until that policy anniversary date that falls in the next year.
Well, likewise, nobody became entitled to the progressive jackpot in the gambling case until somebody put the corner in the slot machine and pulled the lever, right?
Yes.
So, why isn't that analogous?
Well, you had a state regulation that basically said, you know, that basically established the liability regardless of the fact that you didn't have an identifiable group. I mean, you know, you can think of it as the group would have been, you know, the gambling public, but by reason of the gaming regulation that created the liability, the court deemed that was sufficient to fix the liability. It didn't matter, obviously, you know, the identity of the person that pulled the lever and won. So Hughes Properties is somewhat of a unique situation, and we don't think it really is analogous to this situation.
But there are plenty of cases. Hughes is one of them. Let's say you don't need to know who's going to get the money. You just need to know that it's going to be paid, right?
And we're not saying you need to know who's going to get the...
Right. I mean, well, weren't there already some policies that were paid up as of December 31st?
Yes. And
so why doesn't that end the inquiry?
Because they aren't entitled to receive that annual dividend until the policy anniversary date falling in the next year. And that's the New York Life, the Second Circuit held that in the New York Life.
The Second Circuit case, you put so much weight on that case, and yet it's so easily distinguishable from that.
Well, I'll tell you why we put so much weight on it, is because below, Massachusetts Mutual made the exact same argument in support of their dividend guarantee. They said the dividend guarantee is fixed at year end if at least one post-1983 policyholder is entitled to the annual dividend as of December 31. And they said that is the case here because we have all these post-1983 policyholders who had paid their premiums through the next anniversary
date. Right, so there was a guarantee. They were going to get the
money. No, they weren't.
Because
if under the terms of the policy there's an in-force requirement, it doesn't matter if you have paid your premium through the next policy anniversary date. If you surrender that policy the day before the policy anniversary date, you are entitled to zero.
Entitled to zero, but the group of plaintiffs is still entitled to the set amount. Isn't that the critical difference between New York and this case?
Well,
there's a guarantee. The guarantee is a set amount of money to be divided by between however many continue to exist in the group.
But you have to have...
Unlike New York Life, where there was no guarantee of a set amount of money, it was a per-person assessment of individual entitlement.
But you have to have... By the end of the year, there has to be an identifiable group that is entitled to the dividend guarantee.
You said the guy that holds the slot machine doesn't have to be.
When I say identifiable group, I don't mean that the members of the group have to be the people who eventually collect. It doesn't matter if the membership of the group changes over time. But there has to you have to start with some identifiable group in order for the group.
So under your theory, the only way it wouldn't be paid is if people, even those people entitled to the dividend, that the entirety of the policyholders decided to pull their policy that year, every single one of them, and even though they were entitled to this dividend.
Correct. And I know, that sounds...
In which case, given those numbers, MassMutual will be bankrupt for all of the paid-out policies, and this would all be a non-starter. I mean, it's just such an absurd proposition, given the number of individual policyholders that you're talking about. And I thought I understood the Supreme Court in other cases to say, we're not going to consider the extraordinary outlier.
Once you have a fixed obligation... Then, at year end, then the fact that before the obligation is actually satisfied, any number of things can happen. I believe.
But in New York Life, the question was that there was a condition precedent that needed to occur before the obligation could kick in. So in that case, even though the individuals had received medical care, they hadn't put in.
You're talking about General Dynamics?
Oh, I'm sorry, General Dynamics. They hadn't put in their request for the medical care. So that's an easy call. That's an easy way to see why it wouldn't be guaranteed as of that point, because there was a conditions precedent that needed to happen. Here, there's not a conditions precedent that needs to happen to have the right to it. You're saying there is a condition subsequent that could conceivably happen.
I disagree. Because, again, under the terms of the policy, this in-force requirement, no liability to pay this dividend arises unless that policy is in force on that next policy anniversary date.
Well, there is a commitment in the form of the resolution, and there's a very high likelihood that some of them will still be policyholders.
I'm sorry, say again?
There's a very high likelihood that some of them will still be policyholders.
Oh, sure.
And there's a resolution providing a commitment to pay.
But the fact that there's a very high probability is not enough. And I believe the General Dynamics case says that. No matter how statistically certain it may be that the liability is going to arise, if it is not fixed as of year end, it doesn't matter how certain you are that it's going to arise.
Is this a rebate?
I don't think so in the ordinary sense of the word.
It's a return of dividend, isn't it?
Well, I think it's several things. And in part, it may be, in the lingo of the industry, a return or a rebate of the premium. In part, it's a return on equity, you know, the favorable investment experience of the company. So I think, and in part, it's what they call excess interest. So I think there's a number of components, and we submit that the fact that a policyholder dividend may, you know, a part of it may represent a rebate or refund does not qualify you for the exception. There's no, you know, if MassMutual had some kind of way of parsing out, you know, this part is the rebate of the premium, this part is the return on equity, etc., then, you know, they would have, they, I guess they would have an argument that that portion would qualify for the exception. But the regulation, I think, recognizes that, you know, that how difficult that would be. And basically, the IRS, it had previously recognized and issued some field service advisories that, you know, well, you know, this could be a rebate, it could be just a catch-all payment, could be part of both. And so, what, you know, I think it's entirely reasonable for the IRS to have ultimately decided, look, we're just going to have an all-or-nothing rule. You know, only pure rebates are going to be subject, or going to be, are going to be able to take advantage of this exception.
So,
I'm sorry.
Is this going to your deference argument that you didn't raise below?
Well, yes, we do believe that we are entitled to respond to the claims court's discourse on they actually really focused on Chevron deference, which is not applicable here. This is our deference, and you know, the waiver doctrine is phrased in terms of, well, was the issue pressed or passed upon below? And this was definitely, the issue of deference was definitely passed upon. So we don't think that the doctrine of waiver...
And the cases that you cite for the proposition that we're supposed to give you deference, even if the first time you ever interpret this regulation is in litigation, so in a self-serving capacity as an advocate, that you say we should give you deference, but all the cases you cite are situations where the government has come in as an amicus to define what the government believes the position should be, and then the court has said in those circumstances some deference should be afforded the government's interpretation. But you don't cite any cases where the government was actually a party and then raised this issue for the
court. Well, I don't think those courts you know, made the status as an amicus you know, the deciding factor. And I believe the courts have said that even if your interpretation of the regulation, if the agency's interpretation of the regulation is raised for the first time in a legal brief, as long as it reflects its fair and considered judgment, and we submit that these field service advisories going back to the 1990s, the early 1990s, or 1994, demonstrate that the IRS was kicking this around and thinking about it, and that their ultimate decision therefore reflects...
Well, the whole point of deference is to have a considered agency interpretation of a regulation. I mean, putting aside whether or not our deference makes any sense, because I've got some general concerns about whether that law makes a lot of sense. But even if you give the... deference to an interpretation under your theory, every time the IRS gets in litigation, it can say, well, we already have a presumption that we're right, that we win, because we're the government.
Well, I think you have to point to some kind of you know, prior consideration of the issue. It doesn't have to be, you know, in a published ruling. And I think this court in Abbott Laboratories looked at field service advisories and I believe the language was, while they were not definitive, they at least suggested the interpretation that is now explicitly embraced. And that's what these field service advisories do in our case. They say, you know, this could be completely a rebate, it could be completely a catch-all payment, or it could be part of both. That suggests that, you know, the interpretation that was ultimately adopted.
Mr. Cattarell,
yes.
Your rebuttal time is just about consumed, but we'll give you 2 minutes.
Great, thank you.
Mr. Williams.
Yeah, please, the court. I'm B. John Williams with Skadden Arps for MassMutual, and with me at council table is Alan Sworsky. The question, of course, is whether MassMutual's minimum guarantee to pay a minimum amount of aggregate dividends fixes its liability for that minimum amount in the year of the guarantee. The government addresses this core question by confusing conditions preceding to payment with conditions preceding to liability. Its reply is replete with the confusion, and the government repeatedly insists that MassMutual had to know the identity of at least one policyholder by year's end who would be paid.
Now New York Life, the Second Circuit, came down pretty strongly in favor of the government, did it not?
Yes, Your Honor. In New York Life, there was no guarantee. There was no group liability. The liability in New York Life was policyholder by policyholder, just as it was in General Dynamics. That is not the case here.
Interestingly, in New York, like they drop a footnote to say, well, this case out of the Court of Federal Claims is distinguishable, not on the group versus individual grounds, and then says, and if it's not, then we disagree with it. So, do you think that the Second Circuit would have thought that group versus individual made a difference?
It's hard to tell, Your Honor, because the issue wasn't presented to them. They didn't have it to consider. And I don't think that the footnote really matters all that much. If you understand the way the policies worked in New York Life, the liability for each policyholder did not arise until the in-force requirement was met. In our case, we have a group guarantee which existed at the end of the year. It was populated by more than 100,000 policyholders who had paid their premiums through the next anniversary date or paid for life. They didn't owe any more premiums. So what was left simply was their survival and that they didn't cash out their policies.
So is it true that if just one man was left standing, that person would get the whole $18 million guarantee?
$180 million, Your Honor. Yes, it would. And in fact, not only would every person in that group have to die and every person cash out their policy, but it would have to be done before anybody else joined the group. Because the group can change and the people can come in, they can leave.
Nobody new could come and everybody would have to die.
Yes, that's right. Exactly. You'd have to, both of them. And that's just absurd. Certainly,
under the government's theory, is apparently it wouldn't have to be absurd, as long as it's, you know, no matter how remotely, as long as it's possible.
I don't see the government's theory in this case to be any different than their theory in Hughes Properties, which this court decided and was affirmed by the Supreme Court, where clearly a condition precedent to paying out the money was pulling the handle on the lever. I mean, whoever would go, you have to go to Las Vegas, you got to go to that casino, you got to go to that slot machine, you got to put the money in at the right time, and you got to pull the handle. All of those are conditions preceding to the payout. And that's what they're saying here, because we don't know the identity of at least one person who's actually going to be paid until the following year, that somehow undermines the liability to the group. And it's just contrary to Hughes Property, it's contrary to the Washington Post case.
And in Hughes, didn't the court expressly acknowledge that the casino could go out of business, it could go bankrupt, there could be a fire that burns it down? There are unusual, unanticipatable kinds of exceptions that might create non-payment of that progressive jackpot, like everybody dying and nobody joining.
Absolutely, Your Honor. And the federal income tax accounting principles don't take into account absurd possibilities. The federal income tax law just doesn't go there.
Would this be a different scenario if we were talking about five policyholders?
I think it becomes more factually, becomes more a question of fact, but we certainly don't have that situation, and the judge below did not have to deal with it.
Talk about the rebate, because the government says that you should give them deference in terms of their determination of what constitutes a rebate and what doesn't constitute a rebate. In other words, that they can narrow it to the classic, you know, I send in my $50 ticket after I bought, you know, a $200 item and I get my $50 back.
Well, the question is, first of all, by regulation, whether these payments are similar to rebates or refunds. The regulatory language is rebate, refund, or similar payment. So the regulation itself is expansive. Whether a payment is tested as a refund or a rebate is generally tested from the perspective of the recipient, not the payer. And this is why the court below analyzed Section 72 of the code to see how these dividends would be taxed to the policyholders. They are, in fact, not taxable because they're a return of basis. They're regarded as a return of basis because they are a refund. And the tax law does not tax refunds. To use a common non-insurance example, take a manufacturer's rebate. From the recipient's perspective, the payment is a return of part of the purchase price and non-taxable.
Is it your position then that the IRS's interpretation of its own regulation would be unreasonable, or that the IRS's interpretation of its own regulation is not deserving of deference because it's never been articulated before?
There's no authority to support the position that is proffered by the government in this case. Though the field service advices don't interpret the regulation any differently than what we interpret the regulation. There are situations where a policyholder dividend can be taxable. It's called a crossover point, and the court below addressed that issue. There are no crossover point issues in this case. These are all dividends returning part of the premium.
So your position is the field service advisory, though they pre-existed this litigation, they do not clearly state what the IRS wants them to state.
They certainly don't, Your Honor. And in fact, when the Internal Revenue Service and the Treasury Department want to publish guidance that will help, if not bind, the field agents and taxpayers, they do it in a very formal way through either regulation, which you have notice and comment pursuant to the Federal Procedures Act, or a revenue rule. Thank you, the Administrative Procedures Act. I'm getting old.
Aren't we all?
The other way is with
speak for yourself.
What was that, Your Honor? The other way is through revenue rulings or revenue procedures. They also provide informal advice to the field that's case specific. It's not intended to be a broad interpretation of the regulation or the statute. That's not how the advice of the Internal Revenue Service is formal.
I guess I'm just trying to pinpoint your argument. So you've got one argument that says the field advisories, even if they were meaningful, are not very clear. If they had been more clear, are you saying that because field advisories are case specific, they don't get deference, or are you saying that they're for some other reason they're not?
I absolutely agree would argue that they do not deserve deference.
And why?
They do not have the policy review that formal guidance to the field does. They do not. You may have the highest level of review of a field service advice is branch chief. And branch chief is a very responsible position, but it is not a policy position. And it's very rare that any of those advices get reviewed by the associate chief counsel, certainly not by the Chief Counsel, certainly not by the Treasury Department, the Tax Legislative Council, the Assistant Secretary for Tax Policy, the Commissioner of Internal Revenue. All of those policy officials review revenue rulings and regulations. And they know when they publish that it is intended to be the position of the institution. These field service advices are not intended by the institution to be that.
What about them taking a position in litigation? Do you think that the Supreme Court's decision in Chase Bank limited to only when that position is taken as an amicus, or do you think that, that they conceivably could take it as a party advocate?
Your Honor, why do we have courts? The courts ought not to defer to the agency on brief when they're a party litigant. In fact, the way the federal income tax law is applied, and this is true whether you have a deficiency case in the tax court or a refund case in the district court or the Court of Federal Claims, the Internal Revenue Service walks in with a presumption of correctness. And the burden of proving that they're wrong is on the taxpayer in every case involving the merits of a substantive tax issue. To put deference on top of that is basically to say, well, don't bother to come to court. Once the IRS makes up its mind about your position, that's that. That's not the way our legal system works. It's not intended to work that way. I think it's astonishing that they've asked for deference as a litigant. And basically the law is against them because the regulation is not ambiguous. It's expansive. The facts are against them, because government counsel below and all the experts, including the government's experts, testified, as found by the Court of Federal Claims, that the policyholder dividends were a return of premium. So the law is against them, the facts are against them, and the policy of the statute's against them. Because with the policy of the economic performance and the recurring item exception is essentially to try to better match the deduction with the revenue that generated it. And in this case, there's a better aligning of the deduction for the return of premium with the revenue in the year the premiums were paid. So what are they left with? Well, the only thing they're left with is it must be so because we say so. They have no authority for their position, and they certainly do not deserve deference.
I have another question. That is your argument regarding the fact that you told the state regulators who would have the authority to enforce these guarantees, is that important to your argument?
It's certainly factually correct. And the reason the company did it was because the regulator is a proxy for the policyholders.
But how can the regulator enforce something if they don't know the number?
They do, Your Honor. They audit them every year.
Okay, but at the time you inform them of the guarantee, do you inform them of the number?
Yes, Your Honor. It's in the dividend scale is set by the board of directors, and then there's a guarantee, and the number that is fixed. It's in the guarantee.
But the guarantee with the number is provided to the regulators?
Yeah, they have access to it. There's nothing hidden from the regulators.
Okay, that wasn't my point.
Is it sent to them, Your Honor?
You told the regulators that you have a guarantee. Do you tell them what the number is when you tell them that?
I believe so. I believe so, yeah.
Okay.
To wrap up, a condition proceeding to the payment of individuals, as there was in both Washington Post and Hughes, does not affect MassMutual's liability for the aggregate amount owed to the policyholders as a group. The in-force condition relied upon by the government as a condition to individual payment, not to fixing the amount owed. MassMutual's liability for the guaranteed minimum does not depend on who in the group will actually be paid. The guarantee eliminated any need to know who would receive payment, and MassMutual's liability to the group was fixed in the year of the guarantee. The court's opinion below should be affirmed.
Thank you, Mr. Williams. Mr. Catterall has a couple of minutes for rebuttal.
Let's move away from form and get into substance. MassMutual, in their brief, says that General Dynamics is in a positive because that case involves a statistical estimate of liabilities to numerous individuals. That's exactly what we have here. I mean, the amount guaranteed is an amount that, based on experience and the law of large numbers, they have hundreds of thousands of policyholders. MassMutual can predict with virtual statistical certainty it will become obligated to pay in the following year under the in-force requirement of its individual policies. And
but isn't the difference that in General Dynamic what they meant is statistically most people will file the claims
General Dynamics could predict and add and essentially they were self-insuring and they were trying to get on the reserve method, which is you know, only insurance companies can do that. And so the court said it might work under the reserve method, but it won't work under the accrual method. We have the exact same thing here. The companies used to be on the reserve method. Now they're on the accrual method. And we maintain that guarantee or purporting to guarantee a statistically certain to be incurred amount of future obligations, guaranteeing that amount will in fact be incurred, does not create a separate substantive obligation. I mean, in 1984, Congress abandoned statistical probability as the standard for deducting policyholder dividends prior to the year of payment and replaced it with this fixed liability requirement that was intended to delay the deduction for policyholder dividends that were subject to this all-or-nothing scenario under the in-force requirement that prevailed in the industry. And Congress contemplated, when it was enacting these fresh start provisions, that insurers would have to substantively change their business practices in order to satisfy the new accrual standard. And that has not occurred in this case. This MassMutual has not substantively changed its business practices.
Thank you, Mr. Catterall. We'll take the case under advisement.